WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we begin a series of interviews on the body and the mind. Today, Dr. Andrew Weil discusses integrating alternative therapy and conventional medicine. His bestseller, Spontaneous Healing, is about how we can tap the body's natural healing ability. Then Dr. Michael Lerner will discuss integrating alternative and conventional therapy in cancer treatment. It's the subject of his book, Choices in Healing. Also, TV critic David Bianculli begins his look at the new fall season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton is taking a train to the Democratic National Convention, which opens today in Chicago. He's also using the campaign trip to unveil proposals, which he hopes will solidify voters behind him. Today, he proposed an expansion of the Brady Law, which keeps guns away from felons. He says handgun purchases should be barred for those who harm or threaten women and children.
If you're convicted of a felony, you shouldn't have one. If you're a fugitive from the law, you shouldn't have a gun. If you're stalking or harassing women or children, you shouldn't have a gun. And if you commit an act of violence against your spouse or your child, you shouldn't have a gun.
Speakers tonight at the Democratic Convention include Sarah Brady, the wife of James Brady. He is the disabled former press aide to President Reagan. James Brady was wounded during an assassination attempt on Reagan in 1981. Democrats say, unlike Republicans earlier this month, the Democratic National Convention will make room to talk about their party's position on abortion rights. NPR Cheryl Duvall reports.
Although the Democratic platform acknowledges differences of opinion on the issue of abortion, the party has asked Kate Michaelman, director of the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League, to address the convention on Tuesday. That's the day delegates are scheduled to ratify the platform. Michaelman contends that the Democrats are more forthright than the Republicans about where they stand.
the majority of Republicans are deeply pro-choice. But even at the convention in San Diego, they were silenced. That's not going to be true here.
Michael Moon will be one of three speakers to address the platform session. The convention runs through Thursday. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Russian security chief Alexander Lebed today tried to win Kremlin support for his plan to end nearly 2 years of fighting in Chechnya. NPR's Andy Bowers reports from Moscow.
General Lebed's peace plan, worked out with Chechen rebel leaders late last week, has yet to receive the blessing of Russian President Boris Yeltsin. In fact, Yeltsin remains curiously unavailable to meet with Lebed, but the Kremlin's maverick peacemaker did hold talks today with Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin. Lebed says he wants his proposal approved at all levels of the Russian government before signing it with the Chechens. Meanwhile, in Chechnya itself today, a ceasefire continued to hold, but an agreement by both sides to pull forces out of the capital, Grozny, hit a snag. Over the weekend, a band of Chechens managed to disarm a group of Russian soldiers. Although the Chechen leaders have apologized for the incident, the Russians have refused to cooperate until all the stolen weapons are returned. I'm Andy Bowers in Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 27.5 points at 5,695. Trading is light. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down 4.34 points at 1138. This is NPR. The Citadel's first week of school has started. Four female cadets are participating in the rigorous week of freshman training. Drilling, getting uniforms, and receiving a military-style haircut will start their work. They'll also take the cadet oath later today. The top-ranking student at the South Carolina Military School says the four women are doing well. He says there's a noticeable difference from last year when the school was forced to admit Shannon Faulkner. She got sick on the first day and left 4 days later. The Citadel opened its doors to women this past June, 2 days after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the males-only admission policy was discriminatory. An Indian tribe is filing what the Canadian government calls a serious land claim for most of the city of Vancouver, British Columbia. Steve Kruger of member station KPLU reports.
The Musqueam Indian tribe doesn't expect to actually gain title to Canada's third largest city, but the tribe does say it's entitled to financial compensation for the land on which the city has been built. The claim is based on a contention that the tribe historically lived and hunted in the forests where the city of a million people has grown. The Canadian government, which has been settling unresolved British Columbia land claims for the last 20 years, admits that under its land claims criteria, the Musqueams may have a valid case. The last land claim settled with British Columbia Indians awarded $140 million to a small remote tribe for a one-mile square section of forest land in the Nass River Valley. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Kruger.
Doctors in India report Mother Teresa appears to be showing signs of recovery, but they warn she's not out of danger. The nun has had heart trouble and a lung infection. She sat up today for a few minutes in bed with the help of nurses. She asked to see other nuns in her order, and six sisters from Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity visited her. Mother Teresa's been hospitalized in Calcutta for almost a week. She had a high fever brought on by malaria. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're featuring a series of interviews from our archives about the mind and the body. We begin with Dr. Andrew Weil, who has written and lectured extensively on alternative medicine and mind-body interactions. He advocates what he calls integrative therapy, which is incorporating alternative forms of medicine into standard treatment. He teaches at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. Weil is also an ethnopharmacologist who has studied the healing and mind-altering effects of plants and herbs. For 15 years, he worked with the Harvard Botanical Museum. In his bestseller, Spontaneous Healing, Dr. Weil argues that modern medicine is too focused on fighting the agents of disease. Dr. Weil says we can do more to work with the body's defenses to strengthen the body's natural ability to heal itself. I spoke with him after the book was published. I asked him for an example of how doctors fight disease as opposed to working with the body's ability to heal.
I suggested that people look at the names of categories of drugs which are popular in medicine today and notice how many of them begin with the prefix anti. We use antihistamines, antihypertensives, antispasmodics, anti-anxiety drugs, anti-arrhythmic drugs. This is the nature of standard medicine. It uses a great many counteractive and suppressive measures. I think those measures have their place. If symptoms are very severe or life-threatening, obviously you want to counteract them. So as a short-term strategy, that's okay. But my worry is that if you rely on these methods long-term, there are two problems. The first is that you expose patients to unnecessary harm because these kinds of measures by nature are toxic. Secondly, by suppressing illness and counteracting symptoms, I think you often unwittingly strengthen disease processes. You frustrate their expression and make them more resistant to resolution over time. The other approach is to work with the body's natural potential for healing. I think there is a strong tendency of the body to return to a position of health when it's out of balance, because when it's healthy, everything is running most efficiently and using least energy. I think medicine should work from the premise that the body wants to get better and to help it along.
You're particularly suspicious of the kind of medicine that suppresses symptoms, like suppressing a rash with cortisone cream, over a long period of time.
Yes.
As opposed to a problem that you could just treat for a few days and that's that.
Exactly.
What are your fears about what happens when you suppress symptoms for a long time with a pill or an ointment?
I think there are several things that can happen. The first is that the disease can become more resistant to treatment in the future, so that you have to use larger and larger doses of the suppressive measures. A second possibility is that the disease process may spread to other organ systems. That is, it may become more extensive in the body and take worse forms. One example that I gave in the book, Spontaneous Healing, is of a woman I saw who had an autoimmune disease called scleroderma, in which the skin begins to harden. This can produce internal symptoms as well, and especially in the digestive system. She was put on large doses of prednisone and immunosuppressive drugs and fairly quickly went into remission. The disease disappeared from her skin. The visible signs of it were gone. But about a year later, she developed shortness of breath. It turned out she had a rare condition called pulmonary fibrosis, in which normal lung tissue is replaced by useless fibrous tissue. This was clearly an unforeseen consequence, I think, of the use of that kind of suppressive therapy. The same disease process was present in her body, but it now had been driven inward to a much more vital organ, and one which is much more difficult to treat. So I think this is an illustration of the problem of using these kinds of methods over long periods of time.
What's an alternative to suppressing symptoms?
I work with many people with autoimmune diseases, things like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, scleroderma, and so forth. I think by really making changes in all aspects of lifestyle, especially by making changes in diet that can retard inflammatory processes, by using the mind-body connection, which I think is very obvious in these kinds of disorders, the ups and downs of these autoimmune diseases clearly parallel ups and downs of mental states. There are herbs that can be useful. There are some vitamins and supplements that can help retard inflammation. Proper forms of exercise can be very useful. So I think you really want to look at adjusting lifestyle in all aspects and working from the premise that people can get better. I must say that I think one of the most valuable things I do for patients is simply tell them with the authority of a medical doctor that I believe it's possible for them to get better. And many patients tell me they've never heard a doctor say that before.
We know in a lot of modern medicine, when we talk about the mind-body connection, it's kind of described as the placebo effect.
Mm-hmm.
And when you use the word placebo effect, it's usually in the context of controlled experiments, and it's something, you know, we can't really count that the person got better because it was just the placebo effect.
I think what you say there, that phrase, just the placebo effect, is perfectly representative of the way conventional doctors think of this phenomenon. The
mm-hmm.
placebo response, I prefer to call it, is regarded as a nuisance. It's something that messes up your experiments. And we're constantly trying to rule out placebo responses. I think we should be worrying about ruling them in. They're really the meat of medicine. Placebo responses are pure healing responses from within, elicited by belief, unmixed up with the direct effects of treatments which are likely to be harmful. I think the best kind of medicine is the gentlest treatment that produces the maximum healing response. So I think that I'm really working to try to educate doctors to see that placebo responses are their greatest therapeutic ally.
Well, how can doctors work with the placebo effect?
You know, I've always maintained that medicine is an art, not a science. I think it uses the forms of science and it uses information produced by scientific research. But the manner of interacting between a practitioner and a patient is an art form. It involves intuitive sensing of a patient's belief structure, presentation of treatments to patients in ways that interact most profitably with their belief system in order to increase the probability of healing. That does not mean tricking patients. It doesn't mean giving them sugar pills or dummy treatments. It means giving treatments that you genuinely believe in and that you can present with conviction that will impact on their belief system as well, so that whatever the direct effect of the treatment is, you will also get a big halo of a placebo response. That is, you will interact with the body's own healing system.
I'm a very skeptical person by nature, but I find when I'm going to a doctor, particularly if it's any kind of like alternative medicine kind of thing, that I really want to believe, because I figure, you know, I want that placebo effect to work for me.
You know, everyone wants to believe when you go to doctors. And I think that doctors are not very well trained in handling that projection of belief onto them. We don't train doctors in this art form of medicine. We don't teach them about the power of words and how to be extremely careful in choosing the words you say to a sick person.
Well, let me ask you this. When you are taking a potent medicine, do you read all the side effects, or do you not want to know? Because there's that other aspect of it, too, you know, that the mind is very impressionable.
Sure.
And if you're preparing for accelerated heartbeats or a rash on your skin, you know, I always feel, well, you're more likely to get it.
Well, I have to tell you, I don't very often take potent medicines. I mostly practice what I preach. I generally take care of things in myself by taking herbs, by following practices that I recommend myself, which are, because they're natural and dilute, don't have that kind of risk.
Though I should interrupt here and say that one of the things you do preach is that there is an appropriate time, even if you're into alternative therapy, there is an appropriate place for conventional modern medicine.
Absolutely, and I think the great challenge for both doctors and patients is to learn how to recognize and sort out those conditions that should go to standard medicine without delay.
Right, right.
You know, and once you do that, then you have a lot of latitude to experiment with the rest. I think in many cases, the conventional treatments should be regarded as last resorts. You do them after you've exhausted simpler, gentler remedies. If those don't work, you can always go to these strong invasive techniques.
It's funny you should say that, because I think it's usually the other way around, is when people give up on conventional medicine that they end up seeking alternative therapies.
I think that's true. In my own practice, I see that most patients who come to me are people who have really exhausted conventional medicine and often been hurt by it, and this has made them realize that they have to be responsible for their own well-being, and they have to get out there and search for information about other ways of doing it.
Getting back to the side effects for a second. So
yeah.
In the days when you were taking potent medicines, would you read the side effects?
I think I would skim over them quickly and assume that I was not going to experience them, that they were statistically less frequent. And I very much believe in playing the odds. You know, this is another point. I think that most medical doctors don't realize that science has changed very much. We are no longer living in a Newtonian Cartesian universe. We live in a quantum universe where all is probability. There's no certainty. And if you want to live well probabilistically, you have to learn how to be a good gambler. You have to know how to play the odds. And in looking at these potent drugs, the odds are that you're not going to get these statistically less frequent side effects. So I think you can take some comfort from a probabilistic view.
My guest is Dr. Andrew Weil, author of the book Spontaneous Healing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Andrew Weil is my guest. He's the author of the bestseller Spontaneous Healing. The place where the mind-body connection really backfires for me is those occasions where a doctor might think that it's your fault that your problem isn't clearing up. You know, that they've done their job. You know, now it's your turn. And that, you know, you're responsible if you're not getting better.
You know, I was just reading a text that's coming out about Asian healing traditions, and there was a scholarly article about Ayurvedic medicine and its development from ancient India to the present. And there was an a treatise written, this must be something like the 2nd or 3rd century AD, that was talking about why patients don't get better. And some practitioners were saying that it was the patient's fault. Mm-hmm. They didn't follow the instructions. It was their problem. So this is nothing new. But I do think that in recent years, there have been a lot of popular books and New Age therapies which have really tried to argue that disease is a matter of choice in some way, that we give ourselves illnesses, and therefore, if we don't get better, it's our fault. I deplore that kind of writing and argument. I think it's very destructive. Let me give you an interesting example mm-hmm. that I used in the book. When I was at Harvard Medical School in the late 60s, when I would see women with breast cancer, who were mostly women of my grandmother's generation, and I would ask them why they thought they got breast cancer, they always would answer that it had to do with a past injury. It was 20 years ago, I fell against the table and hurt my breast. Now, that idea has no validity, but this is what women thought back then. Today, when I ask women why they think they get breast cancer, no one ever mentions an old injury. Today, it's all, I bottled up my feelings for all those years, or I never expressed the grief I felt about this and that. That's a very significant change in our culture. And I think it has to do with the popularity of all these books about emotional bases of illness. But the problem with it is that it creates a great deal of guilt. And I think that guilt is not a mental state that facilitates healing. So I don't think that's a useful way to think at all.
Well, I think people really do feel responsible for their own illnesses now, that you brought it on yourself in some emotional, psychological, or physical way.
I think there's the element of responsibility comes in more with lifestyle choices that we make. For example, if a person chooses to smoke tobacco, I think they have made a lifestyle choice that has gotten them into an addictive pattern of behavior that may create health consequences in the future. But that's different from saying that you're responsible for having cancer because you didn't express emotions and that you're in some way a bad person. I also mentioned in the book that there's a very interesting study that was done looking at how saints have died in this century. A remarkable number of saints, both Eastern and Western, have died of cancer.
Isn't that reassuring?
It's very reassuring.
What do I mean by that? It means that cancer isn't an expression of, like, your ugly soul or something.
Or a spiritual failing.
Exactly.
It almost looks like an occupational hazard of sainthood.
Now, there's a reverse side of the placebo effect, and you call it the hexing effect. When a doctor says to you, well, you know, I'll give you 6 months to live. It doesn't look good. Nobody gets better with this.
And unfortunately, I think this is extremely common. And I would predict that if you or your listeners just ask in your own circle of friends and acquaintances, you will hear amazing numbers of stories of this kind, that many, many patients have been told in one way or another by doctors that they're not going to get better. Rarely is this done deliberately. Doctors aren't out to make patients feel devastated. It's usually done completely unthinkingly and unconsciously. And to me, it reveals two things. The first is, as I said earlier, that most doctors are really not trained in the art of using words and have no sense of the impact of what they say on patients. But secondly, and I think more worrisome, it reveals deep pessimism in the medical profession about healing. And I think this is a consequence of our not making healing a focus of what we do in medicine. We don't study it. We don't teach it to medical students. We don't systematically collect cases of spontaneous healing. This is not a subject of research. It's not something that's taken seriously. When doctors encounter very dramatic cases of unexpected recovery, these are usually regarded as interesting anecdotes. They're not made centerpieces of the medical model. And I think as a result, our doctors are very pessimistic, and they convey that pessimism in very unconscious ways to patients. But I think that often has very destructive effects, because obviously if belief is one of the major avenues that impacts on the healing system, to have a medical authority tell you that you're not going to get better is a major influence on your belief system.
If you see somebody who has a condition and everyone else you've seen with that condition has died within 6 months, what are you going to say?
I'll say that I don't know whether they can get better, but here are things you can do to help yourself in whatever time you have remaining. That you can feel better, you can lead a more productive life. You know, I work with many patients who have cancer. Most of the people that I work with who have cancer are doing some form of conventional therapy. They want to know what else they can do to improve their chances. And typically, you know, if they ask their oncologists about food and diet, the answer they get is, well, it doesn't matter, just eat a balanced diet. that's not good enough. You know, we know a lot of things that people can do with diet that can improve immune function.
What is spontaneous healing?
I use the word spontaneous there to suggest that this is healing that comes from within, that comes of itself. When you cut your finger, you don't have to believe that your finger is going to heal. You don't have to have somebody pray over it to heal. It heals because the body has the capability of repairing damage in that way. That's something we can see on the surface of the body, but that healing activity goes on at every level of biological organization. In the book Spontaneous Healing, I have a chapter on glimpses of aspects of this healing system at work. One of the examples that I looked at is the repair of DNA. DNA is a very big, complicated molecule. It performs complicated functions. Many things can go wrong in those functions. It can become injured. It can make mistakes. Those mistakes would be disastrous. But in the course of evolution, the DNA molecule itself has created enzymes that it makes for repairing itself. And really, this is a kind of molecular version of cut and paste that goes on all the time in every cell, that damaged bits are snipped out, new structure is replaced. This is a well-known phenomenon. It's taught in biochemistry courses in the first year of medical school. But I think its significance is not seen. This is a real window on the essence of healing, which is spontaneous, even going on at this very basic level of life that's an interface between life and non-life. And I think at any level of biological organization, you can see the same aspect. That is, there is an innate, inborn capacity to diagnose problems, to repair damaged structure, to regenerate lost or missing structure. And I think that this should be the primary focus of medical research, medical teaching, and medical practice.
What would you most like to know now about how the body heals itself?
Well, I'm fascinated by the regenerative potential of the human organism. You know, I mentioned in the book that the liver has spectacular regenerative capacity. You can amputate 2/3 of a liver in animals, and in 24 hours, the remaining bit can regenerate the whole organ. Why can this go on in the liver? Why can't it happen in heart muscle that's lost to a heart attack, for example? Why doesn't it happen if a spinal cord is injured? This capacity for regeneration is a potential within DNA. There are sequences of DNA which, if active, can stimulate the whole sequence of chemical reactions that lead to regeneration in this way. But as cells become more specialized, like heart muscle cells, those sequences of DNA become turned off. But I think it's important to realize that the potential is there. And the problem is, if we can figure out how to turn on the right switches, we might be able to stimulate regeneration in that way.
With many illnesses, including cancer, no matter how grave the condition is, there's usually a very, very, very small percentage of people who get better. And that's usually dismissed as, well, you know, these people, it's the luck of the draw. These people are, you know, it's not necessarily something they did.
Right.
Some people will just naturally get better, but, you know, you can't count on it. What are you trying to do with those exceptional people? What are you trying to learn from looking
at
them?
I want to study them. I want to see this looked at as a serious phenomenon. I want to see us systematically collect cases of this kind, analyze them to see what patterns are there. Mm-hmm. And by the way, cancer is the worst place to look.
Why?
Because it's a special case. The problem is that by the time a cancer is detectable in the body, that already represents a long-term failure of the body's healing mechanisms. In order for a malignant cell to develop into a detectable cancer, this is a long period of time over which all of the body's healing mechanisms have failed. So yet even in that case, we see these cases, relatively rare, of remission. But if you look elsewhere, if you look at other categories of disease, such as autoimmunity, chronic pain, allergies, you see this phenomenon of remission and recovery very, very common. In fact, in some diseases, it's the rule rather than the exception. I think we've made a mistake in what little bit of research has been done on healing has almost entirely been focused on spontaneous remission of cancer. I think that's a tactical mistake. There are much better places to look. But I think if we looked in a systematic fashion, we would begin to see patterns and commonalities that might enable us to make this happen more frequently. I've suggested that we should create a National Institute of Health and Healing within the National Institutes of Health. You know, really, I think our National Institutes of Health are misnamed. They are really National Institutes of Disease and Body Parts. And I think that is representative of the disease focus of medicine rather than the health focus. But if we had a National Institute of Health and Healing, I think one of its functions should be to maintain a national registry of cases of healing that would be extensively cross-referenced by categories of disease, so that, for example, if you develop scleroderma, you or your doctor could call the National Registry and get a list of people who have experienced recovery from scleroderma in your area, and you or your doctor could interview them and find out what they did, and that might give you suggestions for what to do.
Andrew Weil teaches at the University of Arizona Medical School and is the author of Spontaneous Healing, which is now out in paperback. We spoke when the book was first published last year. Andrew Weil will be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Dr. Andrew Weil. Also, Michael Lerner, author of Choices in Healing, discusses the dilemmas in choosing between conventional and alternative approaches to treating cancer. And TV critic David Bianculli begins his look at the new fall season. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Dr. Andrew Weil. He advocates integrating alternative and conventional medicine. He's the author of the bestseller Spontaneous Healing and teaches at the medical school of the University of Arizona.
You have almost like guidelines in your book about where you think conventional medicine is useful and where you think it's not. You want to run through that for us?
Sure. If conventional medicine is outstanding at the treatment of trauma. If I were in a serious car accident, I wouldn't want to go first to an herbalist or an acupuncturist. I'd want to go to a trauma center. It's also, for the moment, good at dealing with acute bacterial infections and in general with crises, with surgical crises like an appendix that's about to rupture or medical crises like a heart attack or pulmonary edema. So for these kinds of things, that's you use conventional medicine. It's good at reconstructive surgery and cosmetic surgery when these are used appropriately at high-risk obstetrical cases. In general, as I said, at crisis medicine. The problem is that we're so good at this that we now tend to treat every condition as if it were a crisis or emergency, and we bring out the heavy artillery as the first line of intervention. And I think that is why we have a healthcare crisis today. That's why we produce the kind of harm we do in medicine. So that it is a real challenge for both doctors and patients to learn to use this system appropriately. My estimate is that it's appropriate for about 10 to 20% of cases of illness.
What kind of problems would you immediately yourself seek alternative therapy for?
Allergy, autoimmunity, that's the lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, scleroderma kind of thing. Most mental disorders, certainly anxiety disorders and panic disorders, chronic pain, chronic back pain, chronic neck pain, a lot of problems of chronic infection or susceptibility to infection, which represent depressed immunity, you know, whether that's very severe as in infection with HIV or minor as in people who just get every bug that's going around. Now, these are big categories of illness, also for, I would say, most gastrointestinal disorders, most skin disorders. I would use conventional medicine in those cases only after I had really done a thorough search and experimented with alternative methods.
You were trained in mainstream medicine. Why did you decide to not practice it yourself?
I never practiced it, and I thought this way before I went to medical school. I'm a botanist by training as well as a physician. I did my undergraduate degree in botany. I have a lifelong interest in plants and a long research interest in medicinal plants. So I've always been interested in nature and the relationship between nature and healing. When I finished my clinical training, I saw what that system was good for, but it seemed to me it produced too much harm. And I really felt I had learned nothing about how to prevent illness, and that seems to be the main function of doctors. It should be. It should be. Doctors should be teachers who teach people how not to get sick in the first place. So I set out to travel around the world and look at healing practices in other cultures and gradually put together my own eclectic blend of medicine.
Since you believe that a lot of illness has some kind of psychological component to it, when you're taking a medical history of a patient who you're treating for the first time, what do you want to know about them?
I really want to know what makes them tick. I want to get a picture of what this person is like. So I ask a lot of very nosy questions about, you know, what's their job like? How do they like it? What is their sex life like? What kind of friends do they have? What do they do for fun? All this, by the way, falls under an area of the medical history called the social history. And this is the first part of the history that medical students and young doctors learn to jettison when they're under time pressure to work with patients. You know, this is considered the soft part of the medical history that's expendable. So it gets cut down to nothing. And my experience is that it is in this area, by asking these kinds of questions, that I most often find the clues to the nature of a problem and possible ways of remedying it.
I'm going to ask you about coffee because you've written
sure.
a lot about it. And it seems like every couple of years a new study comes out that maybe contradicts a study that came out 2 years before. What's your latest thinking about coffee and decaffeinated coffee and the effect it has on the body, on the immune system, on stress, on the digestive system?
Sure. When I take a medical history from patients, I'm very interested in their drug history. Most of the patients that I see are users of legal drugs. Only a few are users of illegal drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very interested in uses of caffeine. I think that of all the caffeine forms of caffeine, coffee is the strongest and the one that's most associated with problems. It is a strong stimulant. It is addictive for most people who use it. I would estimate that about 80% of people who use coffee are addicted, meaning that when they stop, they'll have a withdrawal syndrome. And the withdrawal syndrome is fatigue and a vascular headache, which can be incapacitating, usually lasting for 1 or 2 days. I think that coffee, that there's a lot of individual sensitivity to coffee, but in many people, I think it is the primary cause or an aggravating cause of symptoms, particularly in the stomach and esophagus, the lower intestinal tract. So if people have stomach pain, digestive problems, irritable bowel syndrome, they should not be using coffee. If people have insomnia, they should not be using coffee. And even coffee taken early in the day can cause insomnia or sleep disturbance at night. It can cause restlessness. It can cause anxiety. It can cause heart arrhythmias, really a whole variety of problems. And the only way you find these things out is to stop it and see what happens to you. I would still maintain that I produce about one miracle cure every 2 or 3 weeks by simply getting someone to stop drinking coffee. And I also, you know, in the book, I have a chapter on tonics. a subject that's in ill repute in the West, but again, very much in high esteem in Chinese medicine, where these natural substances are seen as being useful in promoting longevity, resistance, and so forth. One of the tonics that I discuss is green tea, Japanese green tea. There's a very interesting body of medical literature now showing that green tea lowers cholesterol, has significant anti-cancer effects, may be beneficial for the body in the other in other ways. So I think, as a general piece of advice, that if people in America could replace some of the coffee they're drinking with green tea, I think that would be a healthful change. It's milder as a source of caffeine than coffee, but will give a caffeine effect to people who want that, and you'll get some health benefits there which you don't get from coffee.
What do you think of decaffeinated coffee?
I think if you have reason not to drink coffee, you shouldn't drink decaffeinated coffee either, because it's not inert. It's got, first of all, enough caffeine in it to affect some very sensitive people, but it's also got a lot of the other substances in coffee that are irritating, especially to the gastrointestinal tract. So if somebody, for instance, has esophageal reflux, heartburn, gastritis, switching from coffee to decaffeinated coffee is not going to make for much improvement.
You write about diet in your book, Spontaneous Healing, and one of the things you recommend is occasional fasting, either a fruit fast or a more complete fast. What do you think the benefits of fasting are?
I think there's several. First of all, just as a physical technique, fasting for one day frees up a lot of energy because the digestive system uses a great deal of energy to process food. So if, for example, you feel like you're coming down with a cold and you stop eating for a day, that makes a lot of energy available to the body's healing system. And
aren't you supposed to, like, feed a cold and starve a fever?
No, you know, I think I was told that the true interpretation of that is if you feed a cold, you're going to wind up with a fever that you have to starve. So that's a different way of interpreting
that. Oh, I never heard
proverb.
That one.
And that's the trouble with these proverbs.
That's right.
You know?
What do they mean?
Yeah, what do
I never
mean?
Remember that you're supposed to starve a fever and feed a cold or...
But that's what I heard, is that if you go ahead and feed your cold, then you're going to wind up with a fever that you'll have to starve. At any rate, I do see this principle at work, that resting the digestive system for a day mm-hmm. can free up energy.
Uh-huh.
But also, short-term fasting, I think, is a very interesting psychological discipline, because many of us use food to satisfy emotional needs. It's a way of dulling mental feelings, emotional feelings that we're uncomfortable with. And if you shut that door for a day, it's very interesting to see what comes up. You know, I just think it's an interesting technique. It's an interesting practice to do.
What is a fruit fast, which isn't really exactly a fast? You're still eating.
Sure. True fasting is really doing nothing but water or herbal teas. I think a fruit fast, a fruit is very easy for the body to process. So it's a way of giving the digestive system a rest, or if you've overindulged in food and drink for a period of time, just giving your system fruit for a day. I think it's just a nice thing to do for your digestive system.
Mm-hmm. And how much fruit?
I think as much as you want. Realizing, however, that fruit is a fairly concentrated source of sugar, and that's especially true of fruit juice. I often find myself warning people about to be aware that fruit juice, especially, more than fruit itself, is a highly concentrated sugar source. And I think that it should be taken with moderation or diluted with water.
How do you decide what patients to take on? You're a kind of celebrity doctor at this point. Mm-hmm. You don't just have a regular practice, I'm sure. And I believe you have patients from around the world. So who makes the final cut?
My wife, who talks to people on the phone. And at the moment, you know, I was writing this book last year, so I suspended my practice for a while, and now I've been on the road a lot. So I have not been seeing patients. I was seeing patients in the spring. I teach at the University of Arizona, so I often have medical students other doctors observing practice with me. I like to see patients that I think I can help. So I want to see patients who are interesting, who seem motivated, who have medical problems that I think I have something to offer for. You know, it's a kind of feel that I develop of knowing what kinds of patients that I'm likely to work with best.
One last question. I think a fear that a lot of mainstream doctors have about alternative therapies is exploitation, mm-hmm. that patients will be exploited, that a doctor will say, well, through the mind-body connection, I will help you spontaneously heal.
I think that's a very legitimate concern. There mm-hmm. is a tremendous amount of medical nonsense out there. There's a lot of bad practitioners.
Who charge a lot of money.
Who charge a lot of money. And by the way, that applies to conventional medicine as well. So I think, you know, there is no substitute for being an informed wary consumer of healthcare. I think you really have to educate yourself about what's out there, what it can do, what it can't do. And I really feel my mission is to try to train students and other doctors to do what I do, which is really to integrate, to put together the best aspects and practices of conventional and alternative medicine into new combinations, which I like to call integrative medicine, that really work from the premise that the body can get better. There's an enormous demand for this service. The supply of physicians doing it is very limited at the moment, and we've got to make it happen more.
Now, you said you believe in an informed, wary consumer, but that's just the thing. I mean, on the one hand, we're skeptical when we're shopping for the treatment. We don't want to go to the fraud. We don't want to go to the doctors that's going to exploit us and take our money. On the other hand, once we start the therapy, we want to really kind of believe in it so that, you know, the mind-body connection will really work in our favor. It's hard to be a skeptic and a believer at the same time.
Well, I like to think of myself as an open-minded skeptic.
Uh-huh.
And that's different from being a closed-minded skeptic, which is what I see very commonly in medicine today. You know, I think you should, you know, I feel that I'm willing to believe anything, but then I have to see proof of it. I have to see evidence. I have to be able to test something out in my own experience and know that it works. And I recommend that strategy to patients as well.
So being open-minded doesn't mean being a sucker.
No, absolutely not. And I think, as I say, I would like to see more people be open-minded skeptics.
Andrew Weil, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Weil directs the program in integrative medicine at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He's the author of the bestseller Spontaneous Healing, which is now out in paperback. We spoke last summer when the book was first published. Coming up, Michael Lerner on choosing among alternative and conventional approaches in treating cancer. This is Fresh Air. Michael Lerner wrote a book for people with cancer who want to understand the many choices available in conventional medicine and alternative therapies. It's called Choices in Healing. Michael Lerner is the founder and president of Commonweal, a health and environmental research institute in Bolinas, California, which runs residential support programs for people with cancer. Lerner served as a special consultant to the Office of Technology Assessment of the U.S. Congress on its study of unconventional cancer treatments. He won a 1983 MacArthur Fellowship for his work in public health. Lerner says there seems to be a correlation between your personality type and the kind of therapy that will work best for you.
If you are a young woman with a woman in her 30s or 40s with breast cancer, and for you, you are really drawn to prayer, to a support group, to macrobiotic diet, to yoga or tai chi or qigong or whatever the practices are that attract you, to traditional Chinese medicine and so on, then in addition to whatever unknown or partially known specific benefits those therapies may have, the fact that it engages you, the fact that you are making choices that make sense to you, probably reduces stress, and stress is a known tumor enhancer, particularly in animal models, probably in human models as well, probably enhances immune function, does all kinds of good things if it makes sense. Whereas if, by contrast, say you are a 70-year-old woman with breast cancer who's always enjoyed her way of life, you know, say classical music and, you know, a diet with fish and meat and so on, and you develop this cancer and your son or daughter is pushing on you the same things that would make sense to the daughter or son, for you, these may be arduous, foreign, unhelpful approaches that you would only take on if you really had some certainty that for you it would really make a difference in your life. And so we don't know enough to recommend them. But my point is that we do know enough to say that the evidence on a lot of these things, while by no means certain, is very intriguing. It's very provocative. And 10 or 15 years from now, we may know enough about some of them to recommend them as useful adjuncts to standard medical care.
I just want to pass on some, I think, really interesting advice you give in your book, which is that if your 70-year-old mother has cancer and she's not into macrobiotics, instead of trying to force her to change her diet, visit her more often. That will probably do a lot more good.
Yeah, truly so. And in fact, that came from a young man who was actually a practitioner of macrobiotics who had a mother with cancer. And he was talking about how difficult it was for her to get her to go into this, which he was so committed to. And I said to him, you know, it might be helpful if you just went home more often. And later he called me and said, you know, that was really helpful advice.
I'm sure you learned a lot about cancer and its effect on a person and that person's family when your father, the writer Max Lerner, had cancer. And he was 77 when he got cancer. And what kind of cancer was it?
He was diagnosed first with a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and following that with prostate cancer metastatic to the lung. Metastatic means it's extended, traveled to the lung. Prostate cancer metastatic to the lung is supposed to be a very, very poor prognosis. As you know, he lived for another 12 years to die at the age of 89. Both those cancers went into remission. He died of a completely different cancer. And I started this work because of him. I wanted to see if there was something I could find that would be of value to him.
When he was diagnosed with cancer, he was given, what, 6 months to live, I think?
It was unclear, but it was not a good prognosis. It was a year, 6 months to a year, or maybe a little more. But they were not hopeful.
One of the questions was, should he get, was it radiation or chemotherapy?
Chemotherapy.
Chemotherapy. And, mm-hmm. and you were basically recommending against it.
I was recommending that he do whatever made sense to him, mm-hmm. but my own gut feeling was that given what I was hearing from the physician about the prognosis, it seemed to me that the sort of risk-benefit analysis was not great for the chemotherapy, and that had I been him, I would have chosen quality of life and probably not to do the chemotherapy. Now, as it turned out, the chemotherapy was enormously effective dealing with the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and put it into lasting remission. It didn't come back. So, what I learned from my father, and it confirmed what I really most deeply believe, is there is no single right way to do this. And in fact, what I started looking at complementary therapies to see if there'd be something of value to my father. He never used any of the complementary therapies I researched. And he believed that the chemotherapy offered him the best hope. So he took the chemo, and he went through a very difficult chemotherapy. He lost a lot of weight. He aged 10, 15 years. He'd been a very robust, vital 77-year-old man, and in a short period of time, he grew much, much older. But the chemotherapy was part of what saved his life.
Have you found that a lot of mainstream doctors will feel comfortable with patients who, in addition to taking the chemo or the radiation therapy, decide to take a nutritional approach or emphasize some mind-body type of therapy? Because you say to patients in your book, you say, if you're using an unconventional approach in addition to a conventional approach, something that you're very comfortable with, make sure you tell your doctor about it. No, but I'm wondering if the doctor is going to tell you if you want to do it, fine. But personally, I think there's absolutely no reason to believe that's going to help you.
That's probably a pretty common response that doctors have. And I actually don't have too much difficulty with a doctor saying that, as long as he's saying, if you want to do it, fine. Mm-hmm. And if you want to do it, fine, is based on a real assessment on his part that this probably isn't going to do you any harm. But I think that doctors who are open to this, and I really do believe there are more and more of them, if you just take psychological support groups are now pandemic in healthcare, mainstream health systems across the United States. There are support groups for every kind of cancer in many, many mainstream centers. That's a change. It's come about because of patient demand. So I think the doctors are changing because the patients are changing, and the medical marketplace is driven by demand.
Michael Lerner is president of Commonweal in Bolinas, California. His book, Choices in Healing, is now out in paperback. Our series on the body and the mind will continue tomorrow.
Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli on the beginning of the fall season. This is Fresh Air. With the major networks still in reruns or occupied with this week's coverage of the Democratic National Convention, the two smallest expansion networks, Warner Brothers' WB and Paramount's UPN, are using this time to offer sneak previews of most of their new fall shows. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Traditionally, a large part of the summertime TV audience stays away until after Labor Day. It's also a long-standing tradition that the networks don't usually come back from their own unofficial vacations until after the Emmy Awards, which this year are being televised on September 8th. Yet with six networks now trying to get your attention, some of them can't afford to wait. Last week, Fox began presenting fresh episodes of Beverly Hills 90210 and Party of Five, and this week rolls out new episodes of Living Single and New York Undercover. But that premature activity is nothing compared to what UPN and WB are doing. UPN, the so-called fifth network, premieres three new series tonight and another one tomorrow night. WB, the sixth network in terms of both ratings and quality, presents one new series tonight and two more on Wednesday. The most surprising thing about the WB shows is that one of them, tonight's Seventh Heaven, is actually pretty good. It's a comedy drama starring Stephen Collins and Catherine Hicks as the parents of five children, and it's easily the best program WB has ever offered. But if you've been watching WB from the start, that's not as strong a compliment as it sounds. Seventh Heaven is also surprising in one other sense. It's a family TV drama that has religious undertones. As in this scene, when the youngest son takes advantage of mealtime prayer to lobby for a new pet.
Dear God, thank you for this food. And if there really is a God, God, I know you'll find a way to get me that dog I've been wanting. Amen. What?
Well, first of all, let me assure you there really is a God, and secondly, congratulations on going over our heads to get what you want. Good luck.
Over at UPN, the executives had better start praying, too, for better replacement series for their new fall shows. Tonight's sitcom lineup includes Robin Givens and James Avery in a law firm comedy called Sparks, and Sherman Hemsley as an ex-con in Good Behavior. UPN's idea is to copy the Fox strategy of the last few years and target minority audiences, which the major networks are doing a terrible job of serving. But bad shows with African-American casts aren't serving anybody, and the stereotyping here can be brutal. In Sparks, Robin Givens meets the law firm's secretary, played by Kim Whitley, who's introduced as a woman with a severe case of PMS.
Dorice, Mr. Sparks asked me to prepare a client for trial tomorrow. Now, he's going to be here in 10 minutes. You got to help me out here.
Help you out? Yes. You want me to help you out?
Oh, my.
Let me tell you something, little Miss High and Mighty Princess of all you survey. I've known your type since my jump rope days. Mm-hmm. Always the hippest, the prettiest, the girl with the most Valentine's cards, the first girl on the block with breasts. Oh, yes, honey. You never had a pimple, never wore a weave, ate all she wanted, and never gained a pound. Oh, yeah, Missy. I know you inside and out, you with that cute little butt of yours. But let me tell you right now, this is the way it's gonna be down here. So deal with it, girlie, or pack up and move back uptown where you belong.
PMS?
To make matters worse, this pilot episode of Sparks is written and directed by a white guy, Ed Weinberger, one of the original creators of Taxi. He's usually funnier than this. Anything is funnier than this. That's why, by comparison, tomorrow night's Homeboys in Outer Space almost seems entertaining. It's got a third rock from the sun kind of flavor, and it's also got James Doohan in the supporting role of a spaceship engineer. Doohan, of course, played Scotty the Mechanic on the original Star Trek. So that, and the title Homeboys in Outer Space, ought to get this show sampled at least once. Most of the others, though, can and will and should be easily ignored.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, Al Banks, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our series on the mind and body. Dr. David Spiegel discusses his now famous study of the therapeutic effects of support groups for women with breast cancer. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.